Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We are rocking and rolling this spring, and that means you should think about the best ways to declutter your home and office without pulling your hair out. We've got you covered with the best tips from organizational expert and author Sue Crum. Psychologist Dr. Wendy James discusses seeing the signs of suicide and how you can help someone you love get the help they need. Management consultant Tom Payne tells us how to truly ace your job interview, and we feature a chat with musician Kitten and hear her brand new song, Why Wait?
Capture your need for sound.
Spring is coming into full force, and for a lot of us, that means we get an itch to really clean the house and purge ourselves of unnecessary clutter. However, sometimes the task seems overwhelming, and this can dampen our spirits and our efforts. To get us motivated and on the right track is former president of the National Association of Professional Organizers, the San Diego chapter, and author of the book, Clear Your Clutter, 50 Ways to Organize Your Life, Home, or Business So You Can Become More Calm, Focused, and Happy. Sue Crum, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you, Kelly. It's a delight to be here.
So, Sue, I think, you know, some of us feel guilty for letting our home and or office become cluttered. But I guess the first thing to remember is that we're not alone in this challenge.
Oh, gosh, not at all. In fact, more people now than ever are saying they're overwhelmed and they're overloaded. And they've just kind of filled up their environments to bursting. Spring's a great time to kind of take a look at how we're living and how we're working in our workspace and say enough is enough, and to come up with, you know, some decisions that we're going to change and take action.
What is the first step to get us on the right track of clearing out our clutter? Because, I think it can be overwhelming.
Yes, the first step is really kind of admitting that we've got an issue and it's impacting our life in a variety of ways. And when our environments get really cleared up, we really change and have breathing space for new opportunities, new ideas, new creativity. But when our spaces are all clogged up, it's like the word clutter from clotter and blood clots. So think of it just clogging up our systems and not making us as efficient as we can be. So the first step is really kind of admitting that we've got an issue and we don't want to live like that anymore. We don't want to work in that environment anymore. And so it's getting that mindset around that changes the tape from, oh, I've always been disorganized, or, oh, I've always had clutter, to, I can attack this. I can change this behavior. I have the power to do it. So the first step is admitting it. And then the second step is really starting out small for a small success. And that's where most of us make our errors. Most of my audience members and clients that I work with virtually and in person, they've tried to do some big job first. You know, let's do the 3-car garage, you know, in one afternoon. And they start out and it's just a mess. They pull it all out and then they don't know what to do and it gets dark. So we have to start small.
And if you have clutter in both your home and your office, which do you suggest that you attack first?
Whichever one is gnawing at you the most. Whichever one is giving you that pit in the stomach and that what I call chatter clatter with our brain. So we walk in that space and we go, oh, I'm so bad. I should have cleaned this up. It's the one that really gnaws at us and just talks to us first. That's where we should start. And if it's the office and our environment, it may be impacting our work performance, because if we can't find things and we're not as organized as we need to be, we can't be as efficient and effective for other people. And it starts to impact our world of work. For people who aren't in the working world, their home environments might be where to start. But it might even be where to start if somebody is working. Because if you can calm down that home environment, then you can go out into the world of work and slay the dragons easier than when everything is chaotic at home as well.
And when you do start to attack whichever room, like let's say it's your kitchen, let's say that's bothering you the most, do you go in like a clockwards manner? Like how do you start, Sue?
Well, with the kitchen, I would say just start small and start with a junk drawer in the kitchen. Just, you know, say, okay, I'm not tearing apart the whole kitchen and we're not going to have to, you know, go out to eat for 2 weeks straight. I'm just going to do one junk drawer. And by taking out one drawer and just kind of taking that apart and sorting like with like and seeing, well, what really belongs in this drawer. And if the junk drawer or drawers in the kitchen have expanded, it's because no one who's living there knows what's supposed to really happen and live in that space. So I would suggest to your listeners to just start with one drawer and do that and kind of congratulate yourself on that one success. Then go on to another drawer or maybe one cabinet. For some folks, it could be just the freezer, getting rid of the freezer burn meat that's in there or the food that's been in there for so long you have no idea when it went in there. And just take the tasks into small chunks of success. And then you don't have to tear apart the whole kitchen all at once. But by taking an area, maybe the refrigerator one day, maybe the pantry another day, you can start to take back your space and get more in control.
And when you're doing this, like, for example, because I used to be a wee bit of a collector of things. Like, I don't know why. I just was. And then all of a sudden, like, because I had to sort of move around a fair chunk when I was in university and stuff, I just started to realize, I'm like, I don't want this anymore. So I started purging so that I was sort of like a lean, mean moving machine. But, like, if someone's not in that position, because I found, like, I was sort of forced to become that way, and then I've just stayed that way because I appreciate it more. But, like, if someone is you know, staying in the same house for 30 years and, you know, you're just a bit of a collector, how do you nudge yourself out of that rut?
That one's tough, because I kind of say, are you moving in, moving out, or just moving your stuff around? So a lot of our clients with our company, the Red Team, end up, you know, they're going to put their house up for sale. And they've been in it for, say, 30 years or whatever, and they're realizing, oh, my gosh, it's just filled to bursting. So even if people aren't moving and they're kind of been in a place for a long time, they have to decide, has stuff expanded to start to fill all the space available? So they have to kind of say, okay, what have I not used? You know, even though it has still usefulness, what have I not used lately? And by lately, I mean in the last 12 to 16 months. So sometimes people still have sports equipment from sports activities they no longer do. They have all sorts of lawn equipment, but they've had a gardener now for 5 years or 10 years, and they're not needing any of that lawn equipment. Some of the children have grown up and gone away, and they forgot to take their stuff with them. Parents, and I have to give those adult children deadlines and say, okay, it's your stuff. Here's the deadline. By July 4th, come and get it, or it's gone. And we have to just kind of get ruthless with that.
Okay.
And take back our space. Because sometimes people are, you know, downsizing, or what I like to call right-sizing, at different phases of their life, and they don't have the room for it, which is what you noticed when you were moving around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big time. And I've learned a lot from that. And even I'm trying to get better. You know, I'm constantly trying to, because I know one of my issues is that sometimes I don't feel like dealing with the mail. You know, and that's even just one issue where it's like, oh, I should go through that. Not that I don't deal with the bills or whatever, but some things like, oh, I should read that. Oh, I should get. So I really try to get rid of it now, like to make the decision. Yes, I need it. No, I don't. Out, out, out.
Perfect.
But I wanted to ask you as well, when you are in a family setting, is it important for you to enlist the help of your spouse and or your children so that you're all on the same page as a family?
It really kind of depends. I'm working right now with a family on a 3-day project, and the wife has said, oh, my husband's not organized, and later we'll get over to his office space. And I said, you know, what we're doing these 3 days is we're working on her office space, and we can't really change a spouse's behavior. I always say to my audience members, you know, Aldous Huxley said, you can't change anybody else. There's a quote that I use, that you got to change yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just, by that role modeling of her changing her office behavior, sometimes that helps the other spouse to see, oh, you know, she is feeling a little calmer. She does know where everything is. You know, maybe there is, you know, some point to all of this. There must be some reason for all of this. And then family members, it really just depends on the ages. This particular project I'm working on right now, there's a 6-year-old who's too young to really get involved in it, so Grandma went and took her for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And the 10-year-old, though, is right in it, and she's getting a new bedroom out of the deal as we're moving some rooms around. And she's really motivated and went out last night and picked out her new dresser and her new bed, and today we're getting all that assembled and moved in. So getting buy-in from other family members is important if the children are going to be impacted by the new space or the decision. But sometimes it has to just be that individual person who's feeling an overwhelm. And so many of my clients, they just, when they call, they say, I'm on overwhelm. Do you help people on overwhelm? And that's what I hear over and over and over in the last 6 years of my business, that people feel an overwhelm. More and more stuff has come into their lives, and they just started to recognize that the retail therapy that they've been doing hasn't been working. You know, I don't feel good, so I go out and buy something. Or I had a fight with my spouse, so I go out and buy something. And we try to fill that void with stuff, and then all of a sudden it's too much. So I have simple strategies that people can put in place right away. They could do this as soon as we finish the interview, and I have a free ebook that has simple strategies people can do right away to just get started. And they don't have to go out and buy anything. They're just very simple strategies in my free ebook, which is at sucrum.com. S-U-E-C-R-U-M.
What would some of those techniques be, Sue?
Well, one of them, which sounds very, very silly, is to start the day, each day, making your bed. And by making the bed in the bedroom, whether you live alone or not, that's 80% of the bedroom is picked up just with that 1 4-minute process. And I've had audience members and clients who have not done that in the past, and they've just said, oh, well, I live alone, or, you know, I got hurried. I had to hurry out the door to go to work. And I said, all right, just give this some time and put this in place and take action. And they come back to me and they go, I can't believe what a difference it makes. I walk back in the room and I feel a sense of calm. I feel a sense of accomplishment. And it's all in the morning before I've had breakfast, and I'm feeling, oh, boy, I can conquer the day. My bed is made. And it sounds absolutely silly, but it absolutely works.
I totally get that. Good job, Sue. I think that's awesome. What would another one be?
Well, another one is at night, whether you live alone or with a whole bunch of people that are expecting you to be Claire in the kitchen, you announce a time when the kitchen is going to be closed, and you clean up the sink and get everything out of the sink and clean up the kitchen and say, the kitchen is now closed. And you make that announcement loudly and clearly. So anybody who, and you have to kind of go over this with family members and explain what the rules are going to be. But the rules are, once the kitchen is closed, if anybody goes back in, it's like the restaurant that's closed. If anybody goes back in to have a piece of pizza or get a drink or make an ice cream sandwich or whatever they're doing, they're in charge of making sure it disappears because the kitchen is now closed. And they have to ring a bell, announce it loudly, even if they live alone. Because then when they wake up in the morning and they walk into that kitchen, it's a, the restaurant's just ready to open. It looks just perfect. And there's just a calm feeling that starts the day.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is author Sue Crum, helping us to learn how to keep our homes and offices organized. Make sure to check her out on her website, suecrum.com. I guess something I wanted to ask you, Sue, is how do you maintain this new lifestyle? Because it's almost like when you see those people at the gym in January, they're all sort of in a roll, the January joiners, for like a month, and then they fall off. So how do you maintain this over a period of time?
Well, you have to be really diligent. You have to be conscious of the fact that it's coming at us from all areas, and it's have to be slaying dragons continuously. But once you set up some systems, and that's the key, back to the kitchen idea of the junk drawer or the refrigerator or the freezer, and you assign homes to places, homes to your things, then it's kind of like what I call the Jiffy Lube tune-up. You just have to kind of go back and tweak it a little bit every once in a while. Because if you already have decided, you know, in the pantry where spices are going to be or in your office where your files are going to be kept, then it's just kind of going back and doing that little quick Jiffy Lube tune-up for not as long as when you set it up originally, but just kind of tweaking it and staying on top of it. Because the clutter will grow back, and it's like even when we're sleeping, it'll grow back. Mm-hmm. But I think people will get ideas from the free ebook, and I do monthly e-tips, which I send out to folks that get the free ebook, and that gives them specific strategies they can put in place. And I offer virtual coaching online, phone coaching for people who want to get organized, but they live far away.
And again, Sue, where can people get a copy of all of this stuff so that they can start their new life, hopefully?
They can go to Sucrum, S-U-E-C-R-U-M.com, and click on the button for the free ebook, and they'll get simple strategies they can put in place right away, and then they'll receive the monthly e-tips, which will even have more strategies for energized and efficient people to just kind of give them a focus for that particular month. One of my audience members said to me Tuesday, she said that once a month thing is a nice shot in the arm because it just tells me, oh yeah, I can do that and I can do this. And they're just real simple strategies.
And the last question I wanted to ask you, Sue, just because, again, I think this is such an important topic. What do you find is the most, I guess, rewarding for people that actually keep themselves decluttered? Like, what does it bring to their life?
Wow. A client by the name of Pat said to me last year, I worked with that family for 6 months, and the house had really filled up very, very full. And during that process, she kept saying to me and giving me hugs and saying, thank you for giving me back my life. And she just, I mean, would start to cry each time we were there because it was, she was getting back her life that she thought she had totally lost. And the house had filled up so much. She was living in a fantasy world over in Pinterest, but her real world wasn't anything like it. And so she got back breathing space, an opportunity to create and do other things that she wanted to do with her life rather than be so clogged with her clutter.
Awesome. Sue, you are so great. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you, Kelly, for inviting me. It's been fun.
That's author Sue Crum. Again, make sure to check her out on her website for all her information and her free ebook on how to declutter your life, suecrum.com. You're listening to The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
It seems a lot of people these days are either trying to get a job or switching careers, and that means you need to be razor sharp to impress potential employers, especially during the much-dreaded in-person job interviews. To help give us the right tips on how to stand out apart from the crowd is management consultant Tom Payne. Tom, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, I'm delighted to be with you.
Tom, so I guess, you know, if we can be clear right from the start, how important is the actual job interview itself?
Well, the job interview, you have to get to the job interview, but once you're there, that's what's going to make or break you getting the job, because a person has to feel comfortable with you, and they're not going to feel comfortable with you just by reading a resume or follow-up phone calls. They need to be in your presence, and that's the key, the reason why it's so important.
What key points do you need to remember to stand out from the crowd when you're in this interview?
You know, one of the things that I think is misleading most of the folks when they go into an interviewing situation is they think that I need to give them the most reasons and the best reasons, and then I'm going to win. But actually, if you have that rational approach and throw all these facts and data at somebody, it just gets forgotten because they hear the same thing from four or five other candidates, and we don't tend to remember facts and data. So we need to change our approach by highlighting our accomplishments through a memorable medium, which is stories. I use probably when I was interviewing, I would use anywhere from 6 to 10 little short stories during the course of an interview, and the results were phenomenal.
And what do you say to someone who has, you know, done job interviews in the past, but let's say has been, you know, in that company for 5 years or what have you, so is sort of a bit rusty, and now they're going out again? I'm not sure if they would have like a bit of a chip on their shoulder because they've done it in the past and might want to think they know what they're doing, even though it's 5 years later.
Yeah, I got it. You know, I volunteer at the Career Transition Center of Chicago. And so we get people from, I once recently had somebody who was a graduate from Duke University and post-grad in engineering from Stanford University. So two very fine institutions. So nobody could say that this person wasn't very smart. But he was interviewing in exactly the wrong way. And just about everyone we see before they get some sort of training interviews in the wrong way. And it's because they're led by the wrong assumptions. They think the decision is going to be rationally made when it's really more irrational or emotional. They want to hire somebody who they like, somebody who they trust, somebody who inspires hope. And these are all emotions, and they're not reasons.
Tom, what sort of demeanor should you have when you're in this interview? Because we've heard, you know, for the longest time, be confident, don't be too confident. Like, where are you supposed to be on that spectrum?
You know, I think the most important thing to be is to be positive, sunny, and relaxed. One of the person, for example, that I talked to you about that went to Duke and Stanford, he was confronted with this strange situation. He thought he was going on an information interview with a former company, and all of a sudden he finds out a day before that he's going to be interviewed for a job, 9 different interviews that day, and then they're going to fly him to another home office to have 9 other interviews. So 18 interviews in 2 days. Now, what happened with him was we had prepared him so well with stories, answers to the most asked questions, things like that, that he just sat back and was relaxed and confident and smiling and happy and engaged. But I think that that feeling relaxed is what radiates the confidence, and always being positive, having a smile on your face. It's very important.
Tom, what do you say to someone who is being interviewed and maybe asked about, you know, a former employer or what have you, and let's say they do know that you've been let go in the past or what have you, because I've had that happen where they're trying to get out, I guess, why you were let go, but why things didn't work out or why you didn't get that job in itself. So what would you say to someone in that position?
No matter what, during an interview, you're always positive. Sometimes they go on fishing expeditions to see if you disliked your past boss or if you had conflict with them. You know, during an interview, you liked all of your bosses because you learned something from all of them, and that's the approach that you need to take. If you start sounding negative in the slightest, it's going to be the worst thing that you can do, because people like to be around positive people, not around negative people. Now, if you were fired from a past job, and let's say you just didn't get along with your boss, and that's known, it's something that they've uncovered, to say, you know, this past job that I had, I normally have great relations with my bosses, and I've enjoyed working for almost all of them. For whatever reason, I can't understand why it happened, but we just didn't click. And you can be somewhat forthright, but you need to diminish the impact of it by framing it within the context of your larger work history.
Joining us on the show is management consultant Tom Payne. Make sure to check out his website, tompayne.com. Tom, for a young person who is coming out of college or university, what do you want them to keep in mind? Because, you know, they don't have a lot of experience, per se, to back them up.
You know, hopefully the person who was in college did some intern work or some volunteer work or things of that sort to give them experiences to help them understand what their strengths are and how to engage them. But I would say that an individual who's getting out of college should do some things that all job seekers should do. And one is understand your strengths. One of the things that I recommend that all my clients do is go to Strength Finders. It's a website. You can take a strengths assessment for $9.99. I don't get a penny of that, but it gives you some very valuable information about what is inherent or innate with you as far as your strengths. For example, do you have analytical capabilities? This assessment test will let you know that. And when you know your strengths, you can then articulate them to a hiring authority. People who are coming out of college probably have no idea what their strengths are. And I found that most of the people that we coach and consult with at the Career Transition Center in Chicago, they don't know their strengths either, and they could be in their 50s. So that's a critical thing to do, because if you can't articulate your strengths, then you can't tell a hiring authority what your value is.
What are so-called suicide questions, and how does one answer them?
Yeah, there are a lot of good suicide questions that interviewers try to bait you with. One, I think, best ones is, what are your weaknesses? Now, the problem with that question is, like I said, you're always to be positive, but now they've asked you to not only be negative, but be negative about yourself. So what I tell people to do is say a strength, mention the weakness, and say a strength. In other words, you start with a strength, you sandwich it, the weakness, in between two strengths, because you tend to remember what's said first and what's said last. And I'll give you an example, if I may.
Yep.
I would say, for example, you know, it's difficult to tell, to really understand what your strengths are, because we're so biased. So what I did was I took an assessment test, and it said that I had the following strengths, that I could take in large amounts of information, focus in on the most important point, and I also had the willpower to make sure that these solutions were enacted. But it also said I had another weakness, and that was I tend to not engage the people in my team and find out what their input is prior to implementing my solutions. And so what I did was I implemented this a strategic council where I talked to the different members before I would implement solutions and programs that would impact them. And the result was we have a much stronger team now. Now, I basically have said, I'm strong here. This was a weakness I've uncovered. Here's how I deal with it. And it's really become a strength. And so you almost forget the weakness by the time you finish the answer.
When it comes to weaknesses, you know, because I've been asked those questions before as well. And like you said, it's a difficult question to ask. And I do like the sandwich approach. Are they looking, though, for you to come up with like three or four things that you're not good at? Like, can you just get away with that sort of sandwich approach with like just the one thing?
Well, you know, if they are asking for, well, give me an additional weakness, you could volunteer something else that's not a job, that's not essential to the job. What they're trying to find, I find, is they're trying to see if you have the self-awareness to know that everyone has weaknesses, and that's a fact. Another way of doing it, though, I think, is if you have a certain strength that's very strong, typically the weakness is on the flip side of that strength,
mm-hmm.
and you could mention... So if you say, if they ask for another weakness, we'll say, well, here's, you know, something I'm extremely strong in is this, and our strengths tend to be areas where we also have weaknesses on the other side, and the weakness that comes along with this strength is this, but here's how I manage it. And so, again, you would start with a strength, you would then tell the weakness, and then you would make it go away by telling how you manage it.
Okay, I like that. I think that's great. Because I know sometimes I feel like they want you to spit out a couple of things that you're not good at. One of the more common questions I think that a lot of people get asked in an interview, and it seems, you know, fairly tame, but it might not be, is, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself. How do you answer that succinctly without rattling on?
Now, you've just hit upon the absolute right thing. How do you answer succinctly? Because people tend to drone on for about 5 minutes sometimes with that one. And the interviewer is just thinking the whole time, why did I ask this question? This always happens. Here's what I recommend that you do. You mention, you have to frame your strengths throughout this whole thing. The answer should take about 1 minute. So you could say, for example, a framing statement of your value. Well, one of the things about me is I tend to deliver outsized results by simply focusing on the most important thing, and I focus on it until it gets achieved. And I'll give you an example of how this approach of mine worked at the following company. And then you give an example of how this strength produced great results. And then after that, you end with a series of strengths. So I'm an excellent team builder. I'm a creative leader. I enjoy the work that I do, and I have an infectious enthusiasm about my job. And you end with the following question, which of these areas would you like to discuss? Now, you've covered a tremendous amount of ground. All of it's of value to the hiring authority, and yet it's not that long, droning conversation that starts with job one and goes on through job 10.
I wanted to ask you about this because I think in this day and age, it's extremely important, and that's social media. It's such a huge thing. How do you answer questions, or do you have to answer questions about your Facebook profile and or Twitter account?
Well, certainly, you know, there are suicide questions and there are suicide social media accounts, so you need to make sure that you've kept it as clean as possible. But there are ways of utilizing social media, like LinkedIn is one of the most valuable ways of going about using social media to help you with your job search. But there are some strange and unique twists that are coming out now in the job market of using Twitter to file tweesumes. So you have a company, and you can send this company a tweet,
mm-hmm.
and it would have just basically maybe listing one strength, a link to your website or a link to something like your a copy online of your resume or something like that, and it's a 140-character tweesume. So there are ways of using this social media to help you get jobs. But another thing with LinkedIn, go to the companies and then go to the subdirectories within that company, because sometimes they do a micro, a sort of almost like a micro blogging of a job opportunity. So if you go to a company, you look into their sales group or their marketing group, and then you drill down into certain areas within the marketing group, and you can actually find jobs listed there that aren't listed elsewhere because they want someone who feels like they're a good fit and who goes out and finds this opportunity.
And when, you know, we're thinking about heading out there to get a job and do this interview, and hopefully you do make it to the interview stage, I know we've talked about a bunch of things that we're supposed to keep in mind. What do you want at our forefront of our minds, Tom, to make sure that we keep this as the most important tip?
I think that the most important thing is twofold. One, you have to work smarter because most people are running in the wrong direction, so you need to get some instruction on how to prepare for the interview. But the second most important thing, and this is where most people fail, they don't put in the effort. They don't put in the work. The person who had 18 interviews in 2 days was thoroughly prepared and worked extremely hard to get to that level. And consequently, when the opportunity presented itself, what did he hear? He didn't say, we'll get back to you. They said at the end of the second day of interviews, they said, which office do you want to work in? So if you do your job right and work very hard in preparation, you should do fine. You'll outdistance your competitors because most people aren't working smart. And then if they are working smart, they're not working hard enough to get to where they need to be.
A question as well that I would have, which we haven't covered, is financial questions. And I know I've never enjoyed this question, and I'm sure most people cringe at it as well, is when they say, you know, something along the lines of, well, what would you like to make? How do you answer that?
I always answer it in the standpoint of, I'm sure we can come to an agreement on salary. I'm very flexible on this, and I always aim for a win-win situation, but then I quote a range. I think that from what I understand, for positions of this sort, and you should have done your homework as to what this these positions are paying, mm-hmm. Positions of this sort have a range of X to X, and within that range, I think we can come to mutual agreement.
Okay, perfect. Tom, you've been great. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That is management consultant Tom Payne. Again, make sure to check out his website, tompayne.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
In the news recently was the shocking death of fashion designer Loren Scott, longtime companion of Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger, who apparently passed away due to suicide in her New York City apartment. Her death has brought to the forefront a topic that no one really likes to address, suicide, and all the ramifications that go along with it. To help us gain some insight on how to respond to someone in your life who may be suicidal and how to help is psychologist and suicide expert Dr. Wendy James. Dr. James, thank you for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, thanks for having me on. And what is disturbing about this, all suicides are disturbing, but most women cry out for help. And there are statistically, women compose only 1/4 of those who commit suicide. Usually it's a cry for help. And to actually commit the act, and if I'm understanding it right, she hanged herself, which is even more unusual for a woman. And so the rationale for suicide is what we try to avoid as psychologists and counselors because it occurs, 1/4 of them are severe depression, and depression leads to feelings of feeling unworthy and suicide. So as psychologists and counselors, we try to anyone severely depressed make sure that we're watching them very closely. What's interesting and what I'm hearing in this, I didn't see that she was under any help or anybody working with her.
Right.
In or serious depression. And then what happens sometimes, especially maybe at her level and her esteem of a huge estate, is that sometimes we get our stars so high above, whether they're movie stars or music stars, so high above that they don't feel that they can talk to anybody. So for celebrities, it's often a downward spiral, the extent of drugs and alcohol abuse and attempted suicides and suicide. Now, on this, I'm not sure if that's what happened or not, because she was kind of in the back scenes a little bit, as successful as she was.
I actually wanted to ask you as well about the fact that it seems like some people, and it seems like she's a case in point, you know, she was able to hide these feelings, it seems like you said that some people cry out for help and it's apparent and it's evident, but do a lot of people actually, you know, are they able to carry it off, you know, under the radar? Because I feel like I've heard enough stories where family and friends are sometimes just beyond shocked if they've lost someone because they didn't see it coming.
Anyone who's famous seems to be able to carry it off better than a person just normally working and everything, because they have everything around them. Money buys you privacy. They don't want the public to know. and they may go through rehab, but rehab again is usually all you see people go through rehab. It's very short. It's like a month. It's usually for, they'll say it's drug and alcohol abuse, and the longest is a month, and then they go right back to the same habits and same things. Now, we don't know if that was what this was about. But critical, critical, critical out there is anyone who's severely depressed needs to get help. And any psychologist or counselor, if a patient says, I feel suicidal, they're watched closely. As you pointed out, it doesn't look like from what we know now, more knowledge will come out that she was getting any help at all to deal with her depression.
What are some signs, as you know, family and friends and loved ones, what signs should we be looking for or just be aware of? Because I feel like everybody is so often in their own bubble that they don't pick up, even on, let's say, a brother or a sister that's not doing well, unless you know they maybe have chronic mental, you know, struggles.
Right. And that is important, because the person that's going through the suicidal thoughts and depression, they can slip down really, spiral down really far without other people being aware. And so it's important not just for family, but for friends. If their behavior is unusual, if they're lethargic, their sleeping has changed, their thoughts have changed, they're staying home, sleeping more, and you can see the depression. And what happens time and time again is we think, oh, that's okay, it's a normal day. Well, no, it's not. And even when I deal with children, we see a lot of that gets set off with different issues. The same thing occurs. Then the parent or a friend or the bus driver or somebody that sees them every day knows it. But we're, today in society, we seem to be afraid to acknowledge it. This person has mental health issues. They need help. And in addition to that, what's horrible is there's so many times they'll just go to emergency room. And for drug or alcohol addiction, and they won't get the psychological professional help they need. So it's a concern as a psychological professional to monitor any person who's suffering from depression, drug, alcohol abuse, and see the signs of suicidal risk. So for the family, any change of drugs and alcohol, lethargy, not working, staying home, not getting out and being social are some important clues.
I wanted to ask you this as well. You know, when I don't know how to phrase it exactly, but when someone who normally seems to be a well-balanced human being, again, for lack of a better description, if they head down this road of suicidal thoughts, is it actually harder to bring them back because they're under such a dark cloud and it may be shocking for them and they might be embarrassed and they don't want to tell people that things are going poorly?
Yes. Unfortunately, as bad as it sounds, that is true. And when you're a celebrity or a star or well-known, you can hide it. And there was a recent incident with Mindy McReady, who was a singer, and she attempted multiple times to slit her wrist. And there seems to be normally women have a higher incidence of depression before attempted suicide, because women usually are cry for help. Men, on the other hand, make sure when they do it, they're going to be gone quickly. It's just a difference in how they perceive the depression and take care of the depression, and men just tend to make sure it's done versus pills or slitting of wrists, which we can sometimes save them. So it's a system that fails in a way, because today in society we're so isolated in some ways, because as I'm sitting here, and I'm sure you do and your audience, with the computers and the cell phones and people are on video games, and so we forget how important socialization is and how important it is to check on those loved ones that you have. And unless you live in the same house with them, we get busy on everything else.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is psychologist and suicide expert Dr. Wendy James. You can learn more about her on her website, drwendyjames.com. Dr. James, how do you tell the difference of someone who might be sort of down in the dumps talking trash versus someone who really needs help? Because, you know, sometimes you have friends like that who are, you know, negative Nellies, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're heading down that path. But how do you know the difference? How do you know when red lights are going off?
Quite honestly, one of the red lights, and this seems pretty common, is them indicating in a session that I feel like I don't want to live, and I don't know if my life is worth living, and I want to commit suicide. They will actually say those words. And when they say those words and they're in counseling, you know to take them seriously. And what's interesting is so much of the drug and alcohol, which sometimes leads to suicide, is handled in emergency rooms. And that means they're in for a couple of days and out again. So it doesn't solve the situation of what they need to deal with for their depression to get them out of that dark, dark area in their life.
Is the risk of suicide something that can be hereditary? Because I know that I think if it's in your family or someone's done it in your family, it might be very scary for other family members. Is it something to worry about?
I've never seen it hereditary. Now, what I have seen hereditary is drug and alcohol abuse, and that can lead to suicide. But just because one person in the family commits suicide doesn't mean another one will. And please don't be afraid if you have a friend that does that. I mean, a family member that does that.
Do extreme stressful situations, you know, cause thoughts and maybe and or actions of suicide, you know, like financial situations? Because, you know, we've heard that in the past. You know, if someone's completely tanked financially, they seem to take their life, you know, or it's an option. I've heard of a fair amount of males that have done that. And I guess, you know, relationships can be all-consuming as well. Would that be another big cause sometimes? Like if your marriage is broken up or someone that you've loved beyond and then that hasn't worked out for you?
I think you hit on some really good points, and one of them is we're talking about somebody who has tons of money and killed herself because they can hide it away and not have to see someone. And you brought up a good issue on the other side where financially they're just stripped. And yes, it's more often in men that don't want to tell they're married or don't want to tell their spouse or loved one that they are just broke and want to get help. And if they can't get a job in this bad economical situation, then they will commit suicide. And usually when they do, it's done. I mean, they know how they're going to do it and they plan it out. And that's difficult to deal with because if the wife or the significant other doesn't know, they're the only one that could be involved in that, and they can hide it by, I'm going for interviews. But it usually comes up because they're not moving, and it causes conflict in the relationship because they won't talk. And men seem less willing to talk about situations than a woman does. Now, as far as breakups and marriage, I find more depression and upset about what's happening and anger and all the feelings that go along with anger, not to the point of suicide in the cases I've seen. Just a brief overview.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the hardest thing is in rehabilitation centers, there's less and less of them. And we're finding only a 5% long-term success in rehabilitation centers. So this is a serious issue that if we can get, as you indicated, and we've talked about, the family to notice.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, teenagers for a moment, because first of all, I can't imagine being a teenager in this day and age. It was hard enough when I did it, you know, not that long ago. But like, I just feel like there's so many angsty feelings that you have as a teenager, especially I would think if you're a teenage girl, although we know guys go through it too. Should parents really be sort of, you know, aware of their children, like, you know, as they go through those teen years? Because I know, like, you couldn't pay me to be 13 to 16 again. And especially in this day and age, I don't know how they do it.
And, you know, you couldn't pay me to be 13 or 16 again. But, yeah, I look back when I was a child, and I think I was just too busy. I didn't see people getting depressed. But this is very interesting. A study was just out that children are four times more likely to be depressed than adults. And they cited the two areas was stress due to academic and issues and stress due to not knowing how to handle time management. So teenagers are going through this. And yes, more women than men, but I'm finding that to be increasing, and it's looking like it's a situation where parents need to be aware, of course. No late nights, take the phone from them at night so they can sleep. Changes in eating patterns. We all know teens are going to go through their ages, so and they want to be like all their teenage friends, and they are learning where they want to be and what they want to do in life, and they kind of want to group in with a certain group and are trying to decide that. If it's unhealthy, the parents need to be aware of that to get them so they can talk to someone. But it is scary for me because I'm seeing higher rate of depression in children than adults.
Okay. And what final thought, Dr. James, do you want to leave us with? Because I really, you know, I know this is such an important topic, and so many people, again, feel it's taboo. They don't like to discuss, you know, mental challenges. But what do you want to leave us with, again, because this could be something that you know, one of us is going to experience, whether it's something with ourselves or a loved one?
The real goal is to be aware of it. If you think something's not right with a family or a friend, talk to them about it, but also try to get them into help somehow of talking to a counselor or a psychologist, because and it gets more difficult. Women, I find, are easier than men to get to see someone, because if we just turn away, it's occurring more and more in our family and in our communities. So mental illness is serious. And if we can deal with it, where they can work through what they need to change, it can save a lot in the long run of them getting away from depression, feeling worthy, esteem, confidence. That's what leads to it.
Dr. James, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really great to speak with you.
Thank you.
That is psychologist and suicide expert Dr. Wendy James. Again, you can learn more about her on her website, drwendyjames.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is recording artist Kitten from Los Angeles. Kitten has just released her song, Why Wait, and her debut album, Kitten, comes out on June 24th. Kitten, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi.
So I wanted to start off by asking you how you actually decided to pursue, you know, a career in music, because obviously that's a very challenging career path.
Yeah, I think a lot of people say this, but it's true for me as well. It was never really an option not to, I guess. It was just not something I ever thought about not pursuing, you know?
Okay.
So yeah, I think it was just something that I felt I had to do.
And are you attracted to instruments more, or is it like voice? Like, obviously you're a singer, but does a certain instrument sort of speak to you more when you're writing your music?
I mean, lately I've been gravitating mostly towards producing on Ableton and electronically.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm really attracted to a lot of synths and old synths in particular. Yeah, that's how I've been creating most of my music lately.
Do you have a set way of writing your songs, or does it sort of just, you know, vary with regards to your mood and maybe what's even going on in your life?
Yeah, it really just, it depends on what I'm listening to, what's going on in my life, just everything really. Yeah, I think oftentimes, like, I'll write something and I'll really know lyrically where it's coming from and then look back on it later and try to understand it.
Okay. I wanted to ask you as well, if you could talk to us about your new song, Why Wait? You know, what do you want fans to take away from it and people that are maybe going to listen to it for the first time?
I haven't really thought about the song too much, but I think there's a real grandness to the song sonically, and I think lyrically it's more emotional than I set out to have it be when making the music. But I think it's brand and kind of like sonically where I'm at right now. It's a lot of R&B and Arca and like different artists like that.
What artists are inspiring to you the most these days? Like, do you look at sort of top 40 artists, or are you sort of elsewhere on the spectrum?
I think, yeah, really everything. Right now, currently, I'd say, again, a lot of Arca, a lot of Future, a lot of Roxy music. I think a lot of Roxy music inspired the album. and like Nile Rodgers and artists like that.
Is there a dream list of people that you might want to collaborate with in the future? Like, is there like an artist or producer that sort of screams to you like that would be great to work with them?
Yeah, yes. I think, again, like a Brian Ferry would be amazing. Prince would be insane. Ken Marshall would be amazing. All of those people.
Joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show is recording artist Kitten. Make sure to check out her website, kittentheband.com. What can we expect to hear from you on your debut album? Is it a collection of songs, or is there like a common thread, a common theme?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of some songs off the EP and new songs. I think it's the best work off of the EP and then the best work I've been able to do in between those releases. So, I think it kind of takes you on a couple of different journeys. There's a like kind of funky side, a little more guitar driven. Then there's a very like pure electronic side, and then there's at the end like a little bit more like organic kind of like ballady stuff. So I'm really excited about it.
I wanted to ask you about social media. Is it important for you to sort of connect to your fans, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or Instagram? And what does it feel like when they reach out to you? Does it sort of give you a boost?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I pretty much see everything that anyone ever writes. And it's definitely important for me and the band to always respond to them. Yeah, that's always super important to me.
Do you find that social media is helping you and the band get to new heights because of the way that it can help sort of almost inadvertently market yourself, even if you are sort of trying to market yourself? It just seems like if someone likes you and they tweet about you, you know, that's reaching a whole other network of potential fans.
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, I even think visually, like if you have interesting visuals on your social networks, like I think, I don't know, it's a weird way of saying it, but I think someone just on the internet is like, oh, I like this image, and then they look up your music and they like that too, just a new fan.
You've done a lot of touring. What has been your best experience on the road so far, and do you find being on the road is sort of like home, or do you actually prefer to get breaks and actually be able to go home and sort of rest up?
I really love touring, to be honest. Like I think it's definitely helped me to come home for a little while, but I definitely don't get sick on the road, or I haven't yet. I'm sure I will in the future.
And I wanted to ask you, what goals do you have in the next like 12 to 18 months? Where do you want to see you and the band?
Continuing to tour, start eventually headlining bigger and bigger venues, and maintaining more fan base and continuing to please us. As well as do myself creatively.
That's awesome. Well, Kitten, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really awesome to speak with you.
Thank you.
That's recording artist Kitten again. Make sure to check out their website, kittentheband.com.
Thank you.
On behalf of the team, thank you so much for hanging out with us on the show this week. We always appreciate your time. And a big thank you, as always, going to my guests this week, Sue Crum, Dr. Wendy James, Tom Payne, and Kitten, all for being on the show. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Abraham Lincoln. And in the end, it's not the years in your life that count. It's the life in your years. Don't forget to check us out on all of our social media, including on Twitter, at K Alexander Show, our Facebook page, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course, tons of interviews for you on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show, including our new interview with Icona Pop, Chris Cab, and the boys from the electronic dance group, Cash Cash. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.